Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to BT's results conference call for the first quarter ended 30th of June 2017. My name is Nigel, and I'm your coordinator for today. Throughout the presentation, you will remain on listen only. If you need assistance at any time during the call, please key star zero on your telephone and a coordinator will be pleased to assist you. I would like to advise all parties this conference is being recorded today. Now I'll hand you over to Mark Lidiard. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Nigel, and welcome everyone. My name is Mark Lidiard from the investor relations team. Presenting on today's call is Gavin Patterson, Group Chief Executive, and Simon Lowth, Group CFO. They will be joined by the CEOs of our lines of business for the Q&A session. Before we start, I'd just like to draw your attention to the usual forward-looking statements on slide two and our latest annual report for examples of the factors that could cause actual results to differ from any forward-looking statements we may make. Both the slide and the annual report can be found on our website. With that, I'll now hand you over to Gavin.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us. Before I go into the detail of today's results, I want to start with the settlements we have agreed with Deutsche Telekom and Orange in respect of potential warranty claims under the 2015 EE acquisition agreement. These claims arose from the issues we previously announced regarding our operations in Italy. As a result of these settlements, we have taken a specific item charge of 225 million in the quarter, which represents a full and final settlement with Deutsche Telekom and Orange in respect of these issues. This is certainly disappointing, but we believe it is the best possible outcome for all our shareholders. This settlement avoids a protracted period of potential litigation and market uncertainty. I'll now give a brief overview of the financial results for the quarter on slide four. We've delivered an encouraging performance in this quarter. Reported revenue was up 1% on last year at 5.8 billion, and underlying revenue, excluding transit, was up 2.2%. Growth in our consumer businesses, notably from mobile, was partially offset by declines in our enterprise businesses. For example, in public sector and global services, where we are taking action to improve performance. EBITDA was down 2% to 1.8 billion, as the benefit of revenue growth was partially outweighed by weakness in our enterprise businesses, partly due to the continued roll-off of the last two large public sector contracts. In addition, we are investing in customer experience and continuing to see the benefit of this. Normalized free cash flow of 556 million was up 24% on last year, mainly due to favorable working capital movements in the quarter. Finally, we bought back 200 million pounds of our own shares as part of the Orange placement, which fulfills our 100 million pound share buyback commitment for this year and will help offset the dilutive effect of employee share options in future years. Since announcing our Q4 results, we have continued to make good progress in our key areas of strategic focus: customer experience, investing for growth, and cost transformation. Our customer experience metrics have progressed once again this quarter, notably group customer perception, which was up 2.1 points right first time, which improved by 2.5%, and fixed network fault volumes, which are 1.2% lower than last year. We now publish customer experience stats on our consumer, EE, and Openreach websites quarterly. We're well-placed to support the rollout of FTTP in the U.K., and we are committed to working constructively with government, Ofcom, and communication providers to achieve this outcome. We will continue to streamline the business and transform our costs, as demonstrated by our ongoing cost transformation projects. These efficiencies give us more resources to reinvest in customer service and in our networks, and Simon will discuss cost transformation in more detail later. In line with our strategic focus, I would like to highlight two recent developments which will influence how we drive our business going forward. We launched the Openreach consultation on FTTP, and we have announced the combination of our consumer and EE businesses. Looking first to FTTP on slide six. The U.K. is already one of the world's leading digital economies, and BT plays a key role in helping to retain this position in a competitive marketplace. We cover more than 90% of the U.K. with super-fast broadband, and we are now building out our ultra-fast network. This uses a mix of G.fast and FTTP, and will bring a minimum of 100 megabits broadband speed to up to 12 million homes by 2020. So far, we've passed 550,000 homes with ultrafast, with more than 100,000 connections. On top of this, as mentioned earlier, we're well placed to support a larger deployment of FTTP in the UK. The infrastructure investments needed for FTTP rollout are significant and will take time to deliver. We will need a regulatory framework that incentivizes investment and provides a fair economic return. FTTP delivery will also be dependent on customer demand, and therefore Openreach is consulting with CPs, Ofcom and government. Under the right conditions, we could reach over 1 million homes a year with FTTP, and as many as 10 million by the middle of the 2020s. FTTP provides faster speeds and a more reliable service, and we're improving deployment methods all the time, which helps to reduce costs and accelerate delivery. In the Openreach consultation, we've estimated costs at between £300 and £600 per premise passed for the first 10 million premises built. I'm confident that we can reach a win-win solution for all stakeholders, government, Ofcom, other CPs, shareholders, and most importantly, businesses and consumers, for what is one of the most important infrastructure investments for the UK. Today, we have announced the bringing together of our consumer and EE businesses to create a new consumer division, which I will cover on slide 7. This is the natural next step in the integration of EE into BT and allows us to simplify our operating model, strengthen accountabilities and accelerate our transformation. This new division will operate across our three brands, BT, EE and Plusnet, spanning fixed and mobile networks, consumer products and services, as well as content. Based upon today's numbers, it will account for over 40% of the group's revenues and around 32% of EBITDA. Mark Alera, the current chief executive of EE, will lead this new division. Mark has managed the successful integration and strong financial performance of EE since acquisition. Under his leadership, we will accelerate the integration of our consumer businesses and leverage our competitive position as the largest and only fully converged player in the market. The consumer and EE businesses will operate separately for the rest of this financial year. Management will come together from this September to start putting together the strategy and plans for the combined division. Alongside this development, I'm delighted to announce that we have appointed Catherine Ross, currently Chief Executive of Ofwat, as our new Director of Regulatory Affairs. Catherine brings hugely relevant experience to our business and will work with me on developing our regulatory strategy and overseeing our relationship with Ofcom. Both Mark and Catherine will report to me, and I hope you will join me in wishing them every success in their new roles. After almost 4 years as Chief Executive of BT Consumer and 13 years in BT, John Pedder has announced he is stepping down to pursue roles outside the group. I'd like to record my sincere thanks to John for all he has done for BT over a number of years, most recently as CEO of BT Consumer, where he has overseen our rapid expansion in the consumer marketplace. I wish him all the best for the future. John Williams, Chief Strategy Officer, has also decided to leave BT to pursue new opportunities outside the group. Sean has made a major contribution to BT's continued strategic effectiveness in recent years, ensuring we secured regulatory approval for both the EE acquisition and the settlement with Ofcom over the future of Openreach. I wish them both all the very best for the future. Moving now to our performance, to the performance of our lines of business, and I'll start with consumer on slide 8. Our revenue grew 7% in Q1, driven by 4% growth in RGU per customer, continued fibre additions, and also improving ARPU up 8% as we benefited from price rises. Increasing RGUs per customer is a major focus as it leads to improved customer loyalty and lower churn. And on that note, we were pleased to see broadband churn recovering following the price increase last quarter. We continued to strengthen our BT Sport offering and were successful in securing exclusive rights to the European Rugby Champions Cup, which complements our Aviva Premiership rugby rights. These rights were acquired at good value. We continue to invest in customer experience, notably with call onshoring and purchasing higher quality Openreach products. This is bearing fruit with improvements in call waiting time and onshore call handling. Whilst this investment continues to impact EBITDA, which declined 3%, we believe it will deliver value in the longer term. Turning to slide 9, this was another excellent quarter for EE. Revenue was up 4%, our third consecutive quarter of revenue growth, primarily on the back of our More for More strategy, which is delivering value for our customers. The handset acquisition market remains subdued, although we had a strong performance in SIM only, and postpaid churn remains low at 1.1%. We continue to improve customer experience by evolving our proposition through, for example, extending the Apple Music offer, and we have recently announced plans to open 100 new EE stores. EBITDA was up 19%, driven by revenue growth and a slower handset market, which improved indirect costs. I should caution that we don't expect this level of EBITDA growth to continue throughout the year, partly due to the impact of EU roaming cuts and partly because we expect to bear the costs of significant handset launches later in the year. Our 4G geographic coverage is now 83% as we move towards our target of 95% by 2020. And our solution for the emergency services network remains on track. As expected, Ofcom announced the rules for the forthcoming spectrum auction. While we don't agree that the caps are necessary, our focus remains on investing in our network to provide the best mobile experience for our customers. And to that end, and with our plans firmly including upgrades to 4G Pro and 5G, we will be bidding in the auction. Looking at business and public sector on slide 10, underlying revenue was down 3%. A buoyant SME performance benefited from strong IP lines, and mobile sales continued to exceed expectations, highlighting the successful integration of EE's business capabilities into BPS. However, this was offset by continued roll-off of the remaining large public sector contracts, which, as we have previously said, come to an end this financial year. Clearly, we'll continue to have a revenue headwind from these contracts in 18-19 until they drop out of the year-on-year comparisons. As the UK public sector moves away from centralised procurement, our aim is to retain key national accounts whilst growing our local capability, for example, with local NHS trusts. To drive this, we're investing more in local sales teams, which is creating traction and helping drive improved order intake. EBITDA was down 6% due to the known headwinds in public sector. Order intake was up 81%, with First Group and Severn Trent amongst our contract wins and re-signs. Let's move to global services on slide 11. Underlying revenue was down 7%, driven by Italy, the continued insourcing from one client in the Americas and slower contract delivery. We're seeing somewhat weaker market conditions, particularly in Europe, which has also been reflected in the order book, which is down 16%. This quarter, we signed contracts with Telefonica, AXA, and Fujitsu, amongst others. EBITDA was down 39% to $73 million, largely due to the impact of Italy. Refocusing and restructuring of our business continues. As we said last quarter, we are moving towards a more digital and cloud-based offering, streamlining towards core multinational customers, reducing our focus on local network assets, and deploying new technologies such as software-defined networking. These changes will take time and will require investment. In Italy, we are taking action to improve efficiency and competitiveness, and as part of this plan, we're implementing a 20% reduction in headcount of around 200 people. Turning now to wholesale and ventures on slide 12. Underlying revenue was down 4%, primarily due to the decline of legacy services such as partial private circuits. EBITDA was down 13%. As expected, this was larger than the normal seasonal decline, reflecting timing on some of our major wholesale contracts and phone book publication dates. It also reflects the mix effect of declining revenue from legacy services. We look to drive product innovation in ventures. Some of these innovations can have a big potential impact on our business. One to watch will be the new InLink UK from BT Street units to replace some payphones over the next few years. These units, the first of which was launched this quarter, will generate advertising revenues, while providing free public Wi-Fi of up to 1 gigabit per second, free phone calls, and a range of other digital services. On to Openreach on slide 13. Revenue in Q1 was up 1% year-on-year as a result of strong growth in fibre broadband. EBITDA was down 3% due to the impact of increased costs driven by regulatory price changes, increases in business rates, and a higher pensions operating charge. We have further extended the reach of fibre broadband, which now reaches around 27 million premises. And as I've already mentioned, we're rolling out our ultra-fast broadband services. I should note that we have seen a slower broadband market overall, and we also saw significant loss in physical lines at 94,000 in the quarter. We anticipate continued pressure on lines for the rest of the year. We're investing in service improvements to our communications provider customers, and these are starting to bear fruit. For example, fixed network faults are down year on year. Additionally, starting in July, we have reduced the price for a number of our ancillary products, which is likely to result in an impact for Openreach in the low tens of millions this year. We're implementing our plans for a more independent Openreach, including rebranding. We're pleased that Ofcom published its conclusions on the structure of Openreach, which are in line with our expectations. Finally, I should mention that earlier this week, the Competition's Appeal Tribunal upheld our appeal against the market definitions used in the Business Connectivity Market Review. We're currently awaiting both the CAT's full judgment and its order formally enforcing that judgment. We will now be discussing with Ofcom how we formalise that CAT decision and what arrangements could be put in place while Ofcom resets the regulation. There is no change to our current outlook as a result of this. I'll now hand you over to Simon to discuss the financials in more detail before coming back to open up for questions.
Well, thank you, Gavin, and good day to everyone on the call. Over the next few minutes, I'll cover a number of topics. I'll first summarise our financial results for the first quarter. I'll then update you on our productivity and cost transformation programmes. And then lastly, I will recap on our capital allocation framework and in that context provide a brief update on our investment priorities and the status of the pension triennial evaluation. So, starting with the Q1 results on slide 15. Revenue was up 1% in the quarter to £5.8 billion, and underlying revenue was up 0.2%. Our consumer-facing lines of business continued to deliver good revenue growth. Our enterprise-facing lines of business saw a net revenue decline due principally to the previously disclosed public sector contract completions in the UK and ongoing challenging conditions in our international corporate markets. Adjusted costs before depreciation and amortization of £4.1 billion grew 3%. Underlying operating costs after foreign exchange movements of £87 million and excluding transit were up 1.5%. Now, this increase was largely driven by increases in business rates, the pensions operating charge, and BT Sport programme rights, which each increased by around £25 million, and by the increased cost of customer investment. So this led to adjusted EBITDA of £1.8 billion. That's down 2% year-on-year, with underlying EBITDA down 2.5%, as the uplift in EE was more than offset by declines in our enterprise businesses, which included a £21 million EBITDA decline in our Italian business. Our current consumer line of business continues to perform well in a competitive market, with the decline in first quarter EBITDA due principally to continued investment in customer experience, as Gavin has already mentioned. Q1 includes 2 weeks of EU roaming drag, and so the full impact from the changes in regulation will actually be felt from Q2. We expect the impact of EU roaming regulation to now be in the high tens of millions of pounds for this financial year. Moving below EBITDA on slide 16, D&A of £865 million was broadly flat year on year. Our adjusted net finance expense of £129 million was down 16% due to reductions in the average interest rate on net debt and the lower BT Italy debt factoring costs and facility fees. Tax increased to £160 million, leading to a tax rate of 20.2%, which is consistent with the rate we expect for the full year. This resulted in adjusted profit after tax of £631 million, 4% lower than last year. The specific items of £346 million were primarily as a result of EE acquisition warranty claims of £225 million, restructuring costs of £52 million, EE integration costs of £12 million, there's a £27 million regulatory impact, and then a £55 million net interest charge on our pensions. Reported profit for the period after specific items was £285 million. Turning to cash flow on slide 17, and starting with that adjusted EBITDA of £1.8 billion. So tax paid, excluding the cash tax benefit of pension deficit payments, was £96 million, and that's down 35% from last year as a result of overpayments in our first instalment for 16-17. Working capital outflows of £217 million decreased by 38% compared to last year, primarily as a result of strong and early collections in the quarter. We fully expect this position to normalise through the year. Changes in provisions and net finance cash costs were both slightly improved on last year, resulting in cash available for investment and distribution of £1.34 billion. CapEx was up 10% to £784 million. CapEx increase of £73 million was primarily a result of increased investment in our fixed and mobile networks. Total network investment in Q1 was £373 million. Other CapEx categories were broadly flat year on year, £304 million on customer-driven investments and £142 million on systems and IT. Normalised free cash flow was up strongly in the quarter to £556 million, primarily due to the lower working capital outflow compared to last year. Lastly, net debt at the end of Q1 was £8.8 billion. That's down around £120 million since the end of Q4, as the robust free cash flow more than offset the £200 million spent on share buybacks during the quarter. In June, we successfully issued around £2 billion of debt under our EMTN programme at competitive market rates. Now moving at slide 18, cost transformation, including productivity improvement, remains absolutely central to our strategy. We've got annual cash costs of around £19.5 billion, and that's split between our employee costs of about £6 billion and external spend of about £13.5 billion, including CapEx. And the majority of this cost base is clearly addressable through management action. Our current focus on costs fall into three broad areas. We continue to realise the synergies from EE. We're driving our restructuring programmes, as we announced at our Q4 results. And thirdly, we're driving operational performance improvement through productivity programmes and procurement initiatives. On EE synergies, we remain confident and on track to deliver our targets for £400 million of annual cost synergies and £1.6 billion in value of revenue synergies. Our restructuring programs underway across our group functions within TSO and in global services are on track. We continue to expect this program to deliver a payback within 2 years at a cost of £300 million over the 2 years, with most of this being incurred in 2017-18. Our addressable procurement spends around £9 billion a year. While we've got several thousand suppliers overall, we do focus heavily on the 75% of our spend accounted for by our top 200 suppliers. For example, we recently held an innovation day with our strategic technology suppliers to through which they presented us with a range of proposals to drive simplification, innovation, and sustainable value into our business. And finally, we've recently launched a BT-wide customer and performance transformation project to assess the full potential for our businesses. Given the size of BT, we're taking a phased approach to the project and we'll share progress in the coming months. Turning to slide 19, I will briefly describe our capital allocation framework and our priorities. Our strategy aims to deliver sustainable growth in our operating cash flow by driving revenue growth with resilient margins. And our first priority for the allocation of free cash flow is value-enhancing reinvestment in our businesses to drive long-term growth. We're committed to sustaining our leadership in fixed, mobile, and converged networks and to delivering innovative and differentiated propositions and experiences to our customers. Our existing capital plans include rollout of our VDSL and 4G coverage to almost all the country, and investment in 10 million GFast and our ambition for 2 million FTT premises passed by 2020. We're prepared to increase investment beyond our existing capital plans, including to roll out a larger proportion of FTTP, provided that we can be confident of securing fair returns. The outcomes of the ongoing WLA review and the OpenReach FTTP consultation will be critical to shaping our long-term investment plans. Residual cash flow after investment is available to support the pension, to fund the dividend, and maintain a strong balance sheet. The IAS 19 valuation of the pension deficit this quarter was £8 billion net of tax. We're currently engaged in constructive discussions with the BTPS trustees on the triennial pension valuation, including the level and structure of deficit contributions. We aim to complete discussions in the first half of calendar year 2018. We have also opened discussions with scheme members and the unions regarding a review of the BT pension scheme, and we put forward a case for change as a basis to discuss future benefits. We remain committed to our progressive dividend policy. The rate of growth in the dividend will reflect a number of factors, including underlying medium-term earnings growth and levels of business reinvestment. In terms of our debt position, our aim is to maintain a strong through-cycle investment grade rating that's consistent with our current BBB+ rating. We believe that our cash priorities deliver an appropriate balance between investment, commitments to the pension, dividends to shareholders, and managing our balance sheet. And just finally, on slide 20, I'd just like to confirm that there has been no change to our outlook for 17-18. Specifically, we expect revenue for 17-18 to be broadly flat year-on-year, EBITDA of £7.5 to £7.6 billion, and normalised free cash flow of £2.7 to £2.9 billion. And with that, I'll hand you back to Gavin.
Thanks, Simon, and I'll now wrap up briefly. Our strategy remains the right one for our business, which is focused around delivering a great customer experience, investing for growth, and transforming our costs. Today's presentation, I hope, has demonstrated the actions we continue to take in each of these areas. Our businesses are leaders in the core segments they operate in, and we will continue to drive the group forward from this position of strength. While we have challenges ahead, BT can provide the digital infrastructure the UK needs with the most innovative products and services delivered by the best workforce. I remain confident in the outlook for the company. Thank you, and I'll now open up for questions. So let's please have the first question.
So ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please key star then one on your telephone keypad. Your first question is from Maurice Patrick from Barclays. Please go ahead.
Good morning, guys. Maurice here.
Morning, Maurice.
Just a quick question on the, I guess, first of all, on the slowing broadband market that you saw in the quarter, and you've also, I think, flagged line loss likely to remain negative? I guess the driver for why line loss should remain negative, is it mobile substitution? Is it perhaps Project Lightning that's driving that or other factors? And then given the slowing broadband growth, I mean, you do call out RGU per sub growth as important going forward, and I guess convergence is key to that. Your thoughts in terms of how the convergent propositions are developing would be helpful. Thank you.
Very good. I might ask John just to comment on how the convergent propositions have been developing, but just a word on how the broadband market is developing, first of all. You know, the summer months, the two summer quarters tend to be the quieter quarters. There is a seasonality in the marketplace, first of all. And secondly, you know, over time, we are going to reach saturation of broadband penetration. I know we've been talking about it for a while, but we are going to get in the next couple of years a point where there is no more market growth, I think, in broadband. Now, anticipating that, we're increasingly focusing our business on loyalty and retention and driving ARPU growth and RGU growth as a way of driving profitability for the business. And I think that's true both in the consumer business and the EE business today, and you can see that in the more for more strategies that we're operating in. Now, even in a relatively quiet broadband market, by the way, we've still got over 50% market share, 53% market share per se. Then I think in terms of physical line loss, you know, there's probably a little bit of a lightning effect around the edges, but ultimately this is, to some extent, I think, an indication potentially of a couple of things. One is some mobile-only penetration, as particularly where there's a trade-off. And we've seen this a little bit in the past where there's, particularly in some of the lower income households, there is a trade-off between mobile and fixed. And then I think we've seen that cable have come back strongly in Q4 and to some extent Q1 at a time when some of the brands that were operating on the Openreach network were executing price changes. And I think you can see that a little bit in the numbers. So, you know, we can manage the business through these trends, so we're very confident about that. But increasingly, I think it means that we focus on creating extra value and driving additional penetration of the products and services over and above the ones that we have already. In terms of the convergent propositions, John, do you want to have say anything about that?
Yes, on the convergent proposition, so there's currently a discount of £5 on the BT mobile price for BT broadband customer. That proposition works very well, but it's worth, and that's performed particularly strongly this quarter, it's worth just making a couple of observations on it, though. First of all, if you take the price of a quad play from BT and a quad play from EE, although the mobile is a lower headline price from BT thanks to that discount, the combined price for quad play from both brands is actually, in fact, quite similar. And I think there's sort of the perspective I would give on this is that it's important to maximise the advantage that we have from convergence and from quad play, and there's more that we can do on this, I think, in the future. But at the same time, this is not around driving low price propositions that are going to provoke a competitive reaction. That would be a mistake. It's about preserving value in the marketplace and at the same time giving a benefit to our existing customers. I think finally, there's more we can do in terms of value added benefits through converged networks. For example, the BT Wi-Fi network is an asset, and there's more we can do with, for example, to create those converged propositions. So I think you should expect to see more from us on this in the future, but the focus is on sort of preserving the value of the customers.
Very good.
Thank you.
Next question.
Thank you. The next question is from Andrew Lee from Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, everyone. Hi, Gavin. I had a question on regulation, the Ofcom and the CAT decision earlier in the week. And I was wondering if you could talk about the opportunity for adjustments to the Ofcom regulatory decisions in the WLAR. I mean, you have a new head of regulatory affairs, but do you have an open and ongoing dialogue with Ofcom on that, given it's, you know, still the consultation phase? And other regulators across Europe we've seen have moved to rule out material cuts to fibre to cabinet and copper prices because they don't think that incentivises further investment. You know, Ofcom doesn't speak to the investment community to anywhere near the extent that other regulators do. So I was just wondering if you could give us your insight as to the scope for them to adjust its decisions. Thank you.
Interesting question, Andrew. And I might ask Clive to comment as well on this. First on the CAT decision, we're very happy to hear the preliminary CAT conclusion this week, which concluded that Ofcom had erred or made mistakes in terms of the way they defined the market in the business connectivity market review. I think it's a little too early at this stage to say what will happen from here. We need to see the full judgment to understand exactly how they came to that conclusion. And then there's a process that you need to go through where the CAT create an order based on consultation with CPs, and that should happen, I think, in around about September. But at a headline level, you know, we're very happy because we've always felt as though some of the decisions were made in the wrong way. In terms of the ongoing relationship with Ofcom, I would say that it is good and getting better as we come out of the DCR. A couple of points on that. Ofcom's final conclusions around the DCR came out in the quarter, and I think they're pleased with the progress we're making around creating independent governance around Openreach, the formation of the board, the branding, the improvements in service that they've seen, and the ability for Openreach and Clive in particular to consult his customers in a confidential phase are some of the things they talked about in that. And then I think more generally in terms of the discussions around wholesale line access, I feel we're having a good open dialogue with Ofcom on this matter. We're looking to make a fair return for the investments that we've made and that we want to be able to recover costs around increased service in particular, and ensure that investments that we've made in superfast broadband allow us to make a fair return. So the starting place on that is we don't think we've actually got to that point yet, and that the fair bet has not been honoured, and that's one of the points we've made. And then if you put that to one side for a second, the prices that they are proposing for the future really, we think, will not be good for the market. You know, we won't be able to make our regulated cost of capital return, and they'll also disincentivise investment in next-generation products like FTTP, which I know both the government and Ofcom are keen to encourage. And that second point in particular is one that any infrastructure investment, in fact, all the infrastructure investors in the UK feel strongly about, because it affects not just BT, it affects all of them, and it's going to be undermining everybody's business cases. But what I would say is the discussions with Ofcom have gone, I think, well. I think there's an open dialogue, and my sense is that they're listening to some of the points we're making. But Clive, would you like to add your own perspective to that?
Yeah, really, just to reinforce what you said, we have provided a very comprehensive response to Ofcom's WLA consultation, huge amounts of detailed data that Ofcom are now considering around the fair bet return issue, and that's absolutely crucial for us. We have to be able to demonstrate that we are, through the charge control, heading to get a fair bet return in order that we can justify the next wave of investment in full fibre. We've also submitted very detailed information and modelling on the costs of raising service levels across the UK, and we're having very detailed sessions with Ofcom to explain the modelling and take their questions. And similarly, actually, on the cost of raising the capacity on the VDSL platform so that we can drive adoption and get bigger numbers of the UK houses onto the VDSL superfast platform. So we are every week, more than once a week, engaged with Ofcom to explain the details of each of these key areas in order that Ofcom can then properly reflect that detail in their pricing through the charge control. And I'm very happy that we're having very constructive, highly engaged sessions.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Your next question is from Nick Lyle from SocGen. Please go ahead.
Hi, Nick.
Hi there. Hi, Gavin. A couple of questions on business, if that's okay. On VPS, the first one. When I take out the six contracts that you've shown in the presentation, it looks like the underlying public sector and major business revenues are down about 3%, and we're the same last quarter. So are you reasonably happy you've got a handle on the other business now, and is regionalisation starting to benefit you a little bit, not just detract? And the second one was on the GS order book. Orders looked a little bit weak. North America was weak as well. Is this, you know, how much of this is market conditions and how much of it is maybe you pulling back from some of the more far-flung regions now? Thanks.
Great. Well, I'll let Graham talk about BPS and what that looks like, and then I'll make a comment on GS.
Good morning. I think from a revenue perspective, around half the decline now is due to effectively three public sector contracts now. So, you can see that from the charts on the slide. You know, and obviously at an EBITDA level at minus six, the bulk of that is now down to those three contracts as well. And also within the quarter, we've had our best ever quarter on mobile, very strong, but that's brought with it some quite high acquisition costs. So the underlying EBITDA position is pretty solid. Also, order intake is we've had a very, very strong quarter. Obviously, we have one very large wholesale deal in there, but excluding that, what's there is a progression of the strong double-digit order intake increase and that you saw in Q3 and Q4. So Q1, which can be quite a soft quarter, has actually been pretty strong from an order perspective. And I think that's just reinforcing a lot of the work we've done on the ground to build our distribution and our capability, and we'll continue to do that. So I think Q1 has been largely in line with what we expected.
And then on GS, I think it's fair to say the international markets are proving to be proving some headwinds to, I think, everybody, not just GS and its customers at the moment. What we're seeing is the sort of the type of contracts and the mix of contracts is changing. So, there are more smaller contracts and fewer sort of three-digit contract values in the market. That said, we did sign up a number of significant names in the quarter. In terms of what's happening in the Americas, it's a trend of one particular client who was, I think we talked about in previous earnings calls, who is insourcing a business that they had with us for a number of years, and which was a very profitable piece of business for us. So you'll see that wash through the numbers in the next 12 months, and then it'll be out of the base. At an underlying level, we're confident we remain competitive in global services, and we are well placed to help navigate the sort of technology trend that comes with software-defined networks, that we're able to launch those services for our customers because they're beginning to look for them now.
Okay, great, thanks.
Thank you. The next question is from Nick Delfast from Redburn. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks very much. Just a question on the roaming point that you made. Is there any more clarity you can give us on roughly what you're paying per gigabyte when customers roam into the European Union? Just to give us a sort of idea of the scale of the headwind that might occur the following year as well, obviously, because mobile usage continues to go up. Thanks.
Simon, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I'm not going to give you the specific prices on what we're paying, but I think what we have seen is a significant growth in volumes internationally from our customers, something like three times, I think. That's obviously impacted our costs, and then obviously on those coming inbound, we're facing a price squeeze. So you'll have seen we guided to the impact of EU roaming to be in the high tens, and that's a little higher. If you were watching our wording carefully, you'll see more in the mid tens previously. So we are seeing a bit of a upward cost pressure, really on the back of increased volumes.
So while we're on pricing, if I could just have a quick follow-up on broadband. You mentioned that the churn settled back. Obviously, when anyone looks at the prices in the market, there's a huge spread between BT brand and PlusNet and some of the other brands. How would you characterize the stability of that market structure right now between the sort of top-end brands and then the cheaper ones?
John, do you want to?
Yeah, shall I take that? So I think the persistent trend over time has been for people to promote very aggressively on the front book and at the same time take pricing opportunities kind of where they can. And I actually see more continuity than change in that regard. And I would draw your attention to probably TalkTalk's pricing policy in particular, because they've clearly spoken publicly about the importance of getting back to growth and competing for those lower price segment customers, but at the same time, they have just put the price up for their back book of customers too. So I think the same equations always apply, that this is down to all of us to deliver value for the customer, and certainly for BT customers, it's not just a matter that the service should be more expensive, and there has to be more for more too, and that's why things like the service improvements that we've made, the higher care level from OpenReach, the faster speeds too, that's why those things are so important.
In the mobile market, what are you seeing, Mark? Any comments you'd like to make about how the sort of pricing spread is working between the premium brands versus the value brands?
Yeah, I mean, our approach is, you know, we talk about more for more. We've been including more content and services for our customers, as well as an improved customer experience, things like 100% UK call centres, more stores, in order to deliver a more personal service for our customers. And that is allowing us and enabling us to justify a small premium in the marketplace, which is, as you can see, showing through in our revenue growth numbers this quarter and the prior quarter. Still remains a very competitive market, and we're certainly seeing polarization of customers, more customers moving to SIM-only, and we're performing well in the SIM-only market, but a polarization of SIM-only versus handset, and I think we're well placed across the brands to deal with the changes that we're seeing in the marketplace.
Very good.
Thanks.
Next question.
Thank you. Next question is from Paul Sidney from Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Hi, Paul.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my questions. Just a couple of quick questions, please. Firstly, building on an earlier question, are you seeing any change in UK customer behaviour across any of your divisions due to the worsening UK economy? So not just consumer, but also the other divisions as well. And just secondly, your postpaid net adds for mobile, you know, clearly outperforming the UK market, not just in this quarter, but I think, you know, for the best part of the past 18 months. Do you think that network quality is now really starting to resonate with the UK customers, and it's really starting to influence their choice of which network to go to, with obviously yourselves and EE having, again, a clear advantage on network quality? Thanks.
To answer the first question, are we seeing a sort of impact of a tightening of the economy? Maybe around the edges, but I don't see it as significant at this point. I think what we have is a portfolio of brands that allows us to operate in different segments of the market. So if we really want to push value through, or we sense that the opportunities around value-oriented customers are getting greater, we've got PlusNet, for example, that we can you know, turn up the wick on if we want to be more competitive at that level. So I think we're well placed to adapt to changing market conditions, but overall, no real sense that it is biting yet. And it's certainly our view that, be it on mobile or on broadband, you know, we're well placed in any tightening of belts. I mean, we've seen this in the past. These are some of the very last services to go in the household bills. And in the business market, I think again we're well placed through the combination of IP, mobile, and networking to really grow RGUs. And Graham mentioned that earlier. I think we're the addition of mobile into our proposition in business and public sector is proving to be very strong, and I think that's one of the things you're seeing. In terms of network quality, you know, I think we are seeing that network quality is beginning to make a difference to customers, both in terms of the resilience and the quality of the network itself, the coverage of the network. So as we mentioned, we're now at 83% geographic coverage on 4G, well on the way to get to 95% by 2020. The addition of rolling out of higher speeds, such as 4G Pro, we're right at the forefront of that. And these things are, I think, going to increasingly distinguish our brands from others in the marketplace, because I think they'll be very difficult for others to keep up with. So, you know, we're focused on being the market leader, making sure we have the best network, be that either on fixed or wireless. And as Simon said in his comments, you know, the first call on cash is to ensure that we're investing in high-quality network-oriented investments, both in terms of wireless and fixed.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Next question.
Thank you. The next question is from Simon Whedon from Citigroup. Please go ahead.
Hi, Simon.
Yeah, thanks for taking the question. I wonder if you could give us some thoughts about the pluses and minuses you see around the CapEx outlook, the more immediate CapEx outlook, and comment, I know you've touched on it before, but perhaps update us on how much capacity you think you have within the CapEx budget to spend more on fibre to the premise without raising the group's overall CapEx spend above the sort of recent high water marks. And the other question was really whether you're making much progress on streamlining the asset base in global services. So I don't think you've touched too much on that. So if you could elaborate a bit on that, that would be great.
Well, I'll ask Simon to comment on CapEx, and then I'll just have a word on the second question around GS.
Yeah, well, thanks, Simon. So I covered our CapEx outlook in my remarks. Just to remind you, our existing capital plans, which I think are fairly reflected in the sort of market's view, include currently significant investment into the completing of the rollout of the VDSL platform and 4G. And then if you look out over the coming years, we see that investment ramping down and that creating space in our CapEx envelope to invest in our ultra-fast program, so that's the 10 million G-fast and the aspiration to get to 2 million in FTTP. That's our existing capital plans. The consultation that we're undertaking, which is exploring the market demand for the economics of a larger rollout of FTTP, you know, we need to see the results of that consultation to understand what the potential timing might be, the extent to which it mixes or substitutes against the balance of GFAST. These are the questions that we'll be resolving over the process of the consultation. And of course, the WLA review outcome is extremely important in guiding that. There are scenarios certainly in which we can see opportunities to invest in a more extensive FTTP rollout, and if we saw that attracting a good return for us, we would be prepared to lift our CapEx envelope to drive value-creating investment for the business, and we are comfortable that we have got the balance sheet strength to be able to do that while maintaining our commitments to shareholders and indeed to the pension fund.
But on GS, you know, we are moving ahead with restructuring the GS business, you know, focusing on multinational customers, not putting the same priority into our domestic businesses, particularly the ones with the network assets outside of the UK, looking to help our customers move to the next generation of technology, you know, simplifying the service experience. So we're getting on with that restructuring now. As with any part of our business, we continue to look at whether or not we have the right asset mix going forwards, and GS is the same as any other line of business in that respect. And as and when we have something to talk about, we'll make sure you're the first to know.
Thank you.
Next question.
Thank you. The next question from Robert Grindle from Deutsche Bank. Please go ahead.
Good morning. A couple from me. The first is on the wholesale business. Was the new MVNO for Virgin Media a significant contributory factor to the slowdown in wholesale in the quarter? And then the second question is about pension, so sorry for that. I thought perhaps the pension asset value might have gone up this quarter, and it's not just my crazy numbers. I was looking at the pension tracker for insurance company for typical assets of a pension fund, but it went down by $1 billion. So my question is, was there some sort of true down or sort of one-off in the quarter for your pension asset, because this is the important quarter for the actuarial review? Thank you. Or was it just the usual ebb and flow of valuations? Thank you.
I'll ask Jerry to comment on wholesale briefly and then Simon on the pension.
Yeah, on wholesale, though, the question about whether Virgin contributed to that, now, the Virgin contract's been now moving for a couple of quarters, and actually that's moving quite strongly. We did try to flag the slowdown in Q4 when we gave results. Actually, what we've got in there is actually we were accelerating quite a lot of mobile MNO transmission completion in Q4, which affected us. We also had some milestone payments on a large contract, which none of those landed in Q1, which had an effect. And then the last thing is the normal headwinds, which we have spoken about a number of times, which is just the legacy circuits, which are higher margin rolling off. But the mobile side is actually running well.
Nothing specific to call out in the movement in the assets. I think you used the word normal ebb and flow. I think that's a reasonable description. Bear in mind, this is on a asset base that has actually performed well over multiple years. And, of course, the slight decline in the assets was compensated to an extent by a decline in the liabilities, which was registered in an increase in the real discount rate. The other thing to bear in mind, of course, is that the valuation date for the triennial valuation is, of course, June. But do bear in mind that the assumptions used, the actuarial assumptions, differ from the IAS 19 assumptions.
Very good. Next question.
Thank you. The next question is from Matthew Bloxham from JP Morgan. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi there. Just another follow-up on pensions, actually. I think Simon mentioned that you were hoping to get conclusion with the trustees in the first half of next calendar year. I mean, I know previous iterations it's been February. I just kind of wonder whether there's much scope to get an agreement early than that, because I guess that the outcome of the pensions review does have some bearing on, you know, other parts of your investment decisions, maybe, and even shareholder distributions.
I think we've indicated that we expect to complete that process in the first half of 2018, and I'm not going to give you a more specific date. As we've described, these are always involved processes that require a great deal of work from the company and from the trustee. That amount of work is No less this time round. We're looking not just at the normal actuarial process. We are, as I mentioned in my remarks, consulting on the benefit side. And as you also know, we're looking at alternative forms of contributions, potentially underpinned by assets. And we need to give ourselves proper time to complete all of that work to arrive at a solution that is in the interest of all the different stakeholders, and that's what we're committed to doing.
Very good. Thanks, Greg.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Dhananjay Merchandani from Bernstein. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much. My question is related to the management reshuffle around consumer and EE. Why now? What tipped the scales in favor of one executive versus the other? And why are you delaying a more rapid organizational amalgamation of the two segments?
In terms of the timing, this is always the timing we were going for. In the first year of the integration plan, we focused on back office systems, integrating the wholesale businesses and integrating the enterprise businesses. And we always said that we'd do the second stage, which was bringing together the consumer and EE businesses in the second year. In terms of the why isn't it going faster, there's a lot of planning that needs to go into this to ensure that we continue to be able to make both businesses operate to their potential this year, and that we don't drop the ball. We need to make sure that it is done in a way that's good for customers and ensures that there isn't a shock to the business. And then secondly, we've also got to ensure that we protect the tax position as well. And that's one of the things that we've got in mind around the timing of the full integration. That's the way we've been thinking about it. I think ultimately it'll allow us to really realise the full value of being a truly converged network, and that is something that nobody else in the UK has.
And thirdly, why one executive versus the other?
I'm not going to go into the details of that. We were delighted we had two very strong CEOs, and I'm very happy that Mark is going to be the CEO of the combined business. John and I have been talking for a while about what he wanted to do next, and this was an opportunity that he felt was a time to look for other to other things. He's been running the business in one form or another for probably 7 years, maybe longer, and ultimately I think he wants to go and do something else.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question is from Sam McHugh from Exane. Please go ahead.
Yeah, morning guys, and thanks for the questions. Just two from me. On the consumer side, I think if you look at the net adds, 19,000, I think I'm right in saying that includes BT plus Net and EE. Can you clarify whether the BT brand is actually now losing subscribers and whether you've seen the gross addition mix shift in the last 12 months? Then secondly, on capital allocation for Simon, if I look back at BT's capital allocation over the last 8 years, dividend payments have pretty much broadly been equal to pension top-up payments. Now, if I look at consensus going forward, we have a significant discrepancy with much higher dividends and lower top-up payments. Are you comfortable with that, especially in the context of much higher deficit, higher spending on sport, more fibre to the home capex, and also as you go to the unions today and discuss reductions to employee benefits? Thank you.
Okay, Sam. I'll let Simon give you a response to the second question. The first one, very briefly, we've always given an overall share across all brands that we operate in the market. And while the market is a little softer than it has been for previous years, we're very happy with the 53% market share we have. We don't break it out by brand.
Yep, thanks. And in terms of capital allocation, obviously, as I described, we look to the allocation of our cash flow starts with seeking value-creating reinvestment in the business. That is good for our shareholders by driving long-term value It is also good for the pension fund because it creates and strengthens the long-term value of BT and the strength of the covenant. We then look at a balanced allocation of the residual cash flow between different stakeholders. We are absolutely committed to our progressive dividend policy. It's important that our shareholders, who are funding the long-term investment and growth in our business, receive an attractive return on that investment. We're committed to that, and the pension fund understands the importance of that. And then in terms of the pension deficit payments, we will negotiate those and agree those that funding plan with the trustees, and we have to recognise that the debt at any one point in time is volatile. It depends on volatile measures such as real interest rates, and we need to come up with a sensible funding plan for that, and we look at those two in a balanced fashion and look at it over the long term. And I'm not going to prejudge the outcome of the discussion with the trustees.
Very good. Next question.
Yes, thank you,
sir. Thank you. Next question from Steve Malcolm from Arete Research. Please go ahead.
Hi, Steve.
Yes. Good morning, guys. Thanks for taking the question. I'll go for a couple. First, I just want to come back to regulation and some of the points that Clive was making earlier. And I want to ask whether you think that you're confident the current regulatory framework as it stands today is kind of able to allow you to invest in FTTP. And maybe just get Clive to spell out, what is required to give you that confidence. Is it, as you said, some relief on the WLA? Is it spelling out how long the fair bet actually, applies for? Is it possibly including FTTP into the RAB and allowing other products to kind of pick up the slack whilst you invest in this project over time? It'd be good to hear that. And if it's not, if the framework doesn't exist, do you think there may be political appetite to get involved to facilitate this investment? So a few things in there, I'm afraid, but be interested to hear your thoughts on that, particularly from Clive. And just on EE, very good numbers there, particularly on postpaid mobile. Can you just confirm that, you haven't got any funky handset financing in there, split contract upgrade plans? I don't think you do. But as we move to IFRS 15, I guess you're going to have to recognise handset revenues up front. Might that change the way you think, commercially in the market and the offers you put out there? Thanks a lot.
Very good. Clive, briefly on what you need to make the case work,
yes,
for FTTP.
Okay.
Whether or not within the existing framework,
yes,
you feel as though we can make that work. And then Simon wants to talk about funky handsets.
Yeah. So before Simon and funky handsets, then the WLA is hugely important. Coming out of the WLA, we need to establish that we are being permitted to get a fair bet return. If we're not getting a fair bet return on our VDSL platform, it's very difficult to see how we could invest in an FTTP platform, the next generation of technology, so that's absolutely critical. And then we need to see that the cost of service uplift is properly reflected in the WLA. We're absolutely up for raising service levels, but we need the costs recognised and included in the charge control calculations. Equally, we need the ongoing cost of upgrading the existing VDSL platform, particularly with more capacity, with more vectoring capability, accurately reflected in the charge control. So if we can have all of the relevant data, which we put out in our submission, questioned and understood by Ofcom and then fully reflected in the final outcome of the charge control, I think we can create a case to invest in the next generation of technology with confidence and convince our shareholders that this is a good place to invest. I'm confident that we're having all the right discussions from Ofcom, and over the next months we just need to show that the conversations are giving rise to changes that give us the result that I've described.
So, okay. Should we...
Yeah, I mean, just to add, perhaps if I may, Gavin, to Ty's point, I mean, I think that the comments about the fair bet, and particularly in the context of the BDSL investments we made, absolutely right. I think it's fair to say that as we look at FTTP, we certainly would be open to thinking about whether there are different constructs that might make sense. And I think that's a discussion that may flow from the consultation. And we would hope Ofcom would want to consider those if they're in the interest of all parties. Turning to the question about handsets, I do want to put on record we do indeed provide funky handsets as part of our More for More strategy. What we do not provide is funky finance. So we can take that very clearly. I think that as the market moves to IFRS 15, clearly that's going to have quite a significant impact, particularly in the transition period, on the way in which handsets are accounted for. But we will be making decisions about the handset propositions in terms of what is best for our customers and the value we bring, rather than a change in accounting standards. Mark, did you have something you want to add?
The only thing I'd add is if your question comes from the EBITDA performance this quarter, I'd just like to echo the point that Gavin made in his presentation, that we expect a very, very large quarter and some very large handset launches coming up, so don't expect that level of EBITDA performance to continue going into the subsequent quarters.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. Good point. Yeah.
Very good. Well, we've got time for three more questions, so next one, please.
Next question from James Ratzer from New Street Research. Please go ahead.
Hi, James.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. First question I had was just regarding GFast, please. So a couple of questions on that. I mean, you've said in the press release you've got 550,000 homes now passed on Superfast. I was wondering if you could give us a kind of timeline on how that can grow over the next 12 and 24 months. And then also, I mean, you could get quite a nice revenue uplift on GFast with the wholesale price you've said of between £11 and £15 a month. How long is that, do you think, in the fair bet for? When do you think that price comes under charge control? And then the second area I had was going back to, I think, the very first question asked around the line losses in Openreach. One of the issues you mentioned, Gavin, was some of the kind of cable price promotions. That was obviously kind of signaled by Virgin in your Q4, but were kind of suggesting that was going to abate this quarter. I mean, are you suggesting you are still seeing that and therefore cable line losses have been a driver, and maybe therefore if that does abate, the Openreach line losses, albeit negative, could slow a bit in the future quarters? Thank you.
Very good. I'll let Clive comment on both of these, but just to make sure everybody's clear, the 550,000 number I quoted earlier was for ultra-fast coverage. We've got about 100,000 in terms of take-up there. And our ultra-fast plan covers FTTP and GFast. We've always said that we are, we're a mixed technology strategy, between now and 2020, we expect the GFast rollout to get to around 10 million, and another 2 million on top is the goal for FTTP, so 12 million in total. So I don't know whether there's anything specific around GFast in terms of the pricing and the sort of goals for the next 12 months you wanted to talk to there, Clive.
Okay, so just to emphasise that we've been in a trial phase, having deployed an initial footprint for GFast, we've been in a trial phase proving the technology, understanding how best to deploy it. We've done that with multiple CPs, hundreds of customers for multiple CPs. In the autumn, we moved to a pilot phase. We've announced pricing, and the pricing is keen, so it is designed to entice the CPs to launch product on top of GFast. And over the course of this year, you will see the footprint deployment increase quarter by quarter. Right, so we are building, we're building a ramp of deployment on GFast. I think that's what I wanted to say on GFast. I think on line losses, I think we've said it's seasonal. We've said there are multiple drivers of line losses, the kinds of loss that we've seen in the quarter just completed is probably indicative of the level on the average for the year.
There was a question about the fair bet in terms of GFast. I might just add that we are indeed investing in bringing ultra-fast broadband, you know, with GFast, with FTTP, and we are doing so on a fair debt basis. We are putting, you know, our capital at risk to build that, to bring value. And getting clarity around what a fair debt constitutes through the WLA is clearly a very important outcome for us, because it will inform how we think about prospective investment in ultra-fast broadband. You know, I think that applies not just to GFast, it applies to FTTP.
And how long do you think GFast stays out of charge control? Is it 10 years like it was with FTTC?
Well, we will seek to get that clarity out of Ofcom, because clearly the first time we did the fair bet, we left, I think both parties came away with a different understanding of that, because we don't feel yet we've had the returns, the fair bet, and on the FTTC investment, the superfasters.
And as part of the consultation, we are asking that Ofcom clarify, as it were, the rules around fair bet, so that we can apply them again and again to subsequent technology deployments.
Great, thank you.
Very good, thank you. Next question.
And the next question from Sunil Patel from Bank of America. Please go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Hi, Gavin. Two questions for me, both on the consumer merger. One is around the brands. You have a three-band strategy with Plusnet, BT main brand, and EE. Is the idea that we would be merging one of the two brands and moving to sort of a more conventional one premium brand and then one discounted brand, which I imagine will be Plusnet? And then my second question is on the synergies in bringing the two divisions together. If I understand what you said earlier, it sounded like you've actually done a lot of work on the cost side between consumer and EE already, and maybe the opportunity is more on the revenue side going forward. Is that right, or do you see a significant cost saving potential by merging the two divisions together beyond what you could do if they were separate? Thank you.
Firstly, on the brands, you know, we see it as a real strength that we can operate three brands, and when we look at the consumer research on this, there is, you know, each brand operates in a different segment of the marketplace. So we, you know, we can strengthen it a little bit more to really add a little bit more sharpness to the positioning. But we're very comfortable operating three brands, and it allows us, I think, to be able to cover more of the market. What you see when you look at any one brand in our marketplace, when it comes to consideration, so, you know, the percentage of customers who would consider you as a choice, there's no brand in the market that has more than around 50% consideration. So, you know, as much as we'd like to think that, you know, our brands, and I know other people in the market feel the same way, can cover 100% of the market, the reality is customers don't see it that way. Consumers want choice, and, you know, we can derive, you know, we can really realize the synergies at an operating level, both in terms of the network and the way we market the brands. We can get those synergy benefits while still maintaining three different brands in the market. So we're comfortable with that. In terms of the synergies themselves, you know, we set out when we acquired a four-year strategy to realize both cost synergies and revenue synergies. We reported in Q4 the first year performance, and the number was 150 versus an original target of 100, so we're well on track. In fact, we're beating the first year, and we remain confident of delivering the number of 400 million, which is the running rate synergy for costs in year four. We always saw that the combined consumer units would contribute towards that. So there are cost synergies that will come from this, but at the same time, we're very excited about the new propositions that will come from combining the two businesses together. So building a next generation of propositions that pull them to pull
pull the two businesses together. I don't know whether, Mark, you wanted to add any comments from your perspective.
No, I'll just echo that. You know, a large part of the synergies, you know, we'd already projected over the coming years as part of the integration. Obviously, over the coming months, from when I take up the role in from the start of September, we'll be explaining a bit more about the propositions and the roadmap and the future direction for the new combined unit.
Very good. Last
Thank
question.
You.
Thank you. The final question comes from Stephen Howard from HSBC. Please go ahead.
Thank you. So, first question, I'm just wondering whether settlement of the warranty claims with DT and Orange risks triggering liabilities to any other parties. And secondly, back to the FTTP consultation, what happens if it turns out that Openreach customers will pay the level of incremental fees that you've discussed, but the WLA consultation winds up cutting the Vula Foundation price substantially? How do you weigh those two factors relative to one another? Thanks.
I'll take the first question, and then maybe Simon, do you want to just talk about the relative impact of Vula versus premium for FTTP? In terms of the warranties, these warranties only existed for Orange and DT because they were part of the transaction in the first place. So there's nobody else who has this has these warranties, so it shouldn't trigger anything else. With respect to the transaction. In terms of, I think, Clag, did you want to say something on that? No. Sam was going to answer.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to take that. And I think the case for investment in FTTP, you know, we clearly need to see a price that is acceptable to the market and drives take-up in the market that provides us with a fair return on our investment. We start there. In our case, some of that return comes through the pricing up from a superfast product, for example, to an ultrafast product. But some of the return comes from people trading from an ADSL product up to a FTT product. And that, you know, clearly, if you have the reduction in the basic GEA product, if the fiber product, ultrafast product, follows that down, that preserves the investments on those that are trading up from one fiber to another, but it crushes the return on those going from ADSL to a fiber product, and that will therefore impact returns, and we've made this point clearly. And that issue is amplified for pure fiber players, for example, so new investment, new infrastructure providers. So I think a point we've made consistently is that lowering the price of the GEA product will act as a deterrent to and disincentive to investment in fiber.
By us and by all other
players. By us and by others, that's right. Yeah.
Very good. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thank you for joining us on today's call. If you've got any other questions, please can you follow up with Mark or one of the IR team, and with that I wish you a very happy summer.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. That does conclude your conference call for today. You may now disconnect. Thanks for joining. Enjoy the rest of your day.